What is up, everybody, and welcome back to the Primal King Podcast. This is episode number 54. All right, so this is something new for us because today we actually have on a guest who is a woman, and it's not my wife. So in this new year, we're going to be doing a little bit different things here, throwing things up a little bit. So I hope you all enjoy this, and I'm really, really excited to be able to introduce everybody to this guest today. All right, let's get started. So the question is this: how do we live the best life that we can with the limited amount of time that we get to be here? Is it by accumulating success and fame and fortune and everything else that society tells us that we need in order to be fulfilled? Or is it much more simple than that? My name is Derek Wilson. I'm the host of the Primal King Podcast, and we're going to be answering this as well as many other questions as we move forward. All right, so welcome back, everybody. We have such an awesome guest today. She's actually only the second woman who we've had on the Primal King Podcast, and I'm so excited. This is someone who was raised by a single mother in Southern California's low-income neighborhoods. She joined the Air Force at age 19 and served 6 years, including 5 years of active duty, and earned the Air Force Achievement Medal. She's a small business owner and also went on to earn a degree in biology. Her husband, Andy, is a special forces operator who was shot in Afghanistan and also earned the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. Now she's on a new mission to represent Florida's 13th congressional district. She's already won the Republican primary in what many considered an upset and looks to win the general election coming up on November 3rd. She was gracious enough to take time out of her schedule a couple months ago to call my daughter after her 4-H steer died, which should tell you all you need to know about her character. I want to welcome everybody, Ms. Ana Paulina Luna. Thanks again, Ana, for coming on.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Yes. So I was kind of looking, doing some prep and everything for the show, and I guess kind of where I wanted to start is it sounded like you had kind of maybe a little bit of an interesting upbringing in the sense of, you know, kind of like the single mother. It sounds like maybe you were around kind of some rough neighborhoods and stuff like that. So I was wondering if you wouldn't mind, just so everybody kind of gets an idea of kind of where you came from. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind kind of letting us know how that was growing up and what you were kind of going through.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, my upbringing is not average for someone that especially enters into the political arena, I think, as a Republican, right? At least not how we're branded usually by the mainstream media. But really, I mean, my mom had me very young. She ultimately chose to have me instead of getting an abortion. And my dad, you know, was not at all ready to be a father. My dad was really, I think, focused on basically a drug addiction, right? So my dad was not in the picture all that much. And although my dad is now sober and he's a good person, you know, when people are using, they're completely different people. And I think that, you know, anyone who's had a family member that struggles with addiction realizes that. So, you know, my mom in her own story actually grew up in a heroin house. My grandmother, Judy, so her mother died of AIDS due to heroin use. Her dad was not in the picture at all. In fact, she didn't meet her biological father until I think she was around 18 years old. So my mom was really, I mean, my story is pretty incredible, but my mom's story is, if not more incredible, just because of the fact that she was essentially homeless, basically in a heroin house, and ultimately ended up being able to really put herself through college with, you know, myself and my two younger siblings. But really, I mean, in my mom's experience, it was her and I just for a really long time. And my parents were divorced. So I knew that I still wanted to see my dad. And I think, like, you being a father and anyone who's been really in that situation where you have to share custody, I knew that if my mom knew what was going on with my dad and just kind of what I was being exposed to, I just knew even as a little kid that it wasn't right what my dad was doing. But I also didn't want to tell my mom because I didn't want to not be able to see my dad. So really, you had my mom kind of protecting me, or trying to at least protect me from what really everything that she fully saw. But then on the other hand, you had me fully exposed to it along with my father as well. And I remember, I think when my mom started to kind of pick up that I was, you know, hiding stuff, she had actually ended up picking me up at a hotel. And my dad had been arrested and left me in one of the hotel rooms with one of his drug buddy's friends, and ultimately ended up being a crack hotel. So you could understand, my mom picks me up, she's like, oh my gosh, where's my daughter? But I realize now, and it took me really joining the military to understand that that's not normal circumstance. And it's kind of funny because the military isn't really normal either. But I, you know, I was able to kind of realize that, you know, structure is something that I very much so lacked in my upbringing. by the time I graduated, I had gone to 6 different high schools, and it was really the way that I saw as getting out of that situation. I was actually at a house party, and I overheard 2 younger guys talking about how they were starting classes, and so I asked them how they were doing that, because they're kind of my age. They're maybe 18 years old, and they said, oh, well, we're in the Marines, and I said, well, what's a Marine? And so I ultimately ended up going to talk to a recruiter. I didn't tell anyone in my family. And then 2 months prior to me leaving, I actually told my mom and my dad that I was actually leaving for boot camp. And, you know, I'm sure you can imagine they freaked out, because this was really at the start off of the global war on terror. But it was the best thing that I could have done. And when I talk on policy, especially with firearms, especially with reforming the welfare system, especially on conservative values, I come at it from a different perspective, because I've lived in a system that is many times taught as a talking point by the Democrat Party, and taught to be a way that we should be catering to for people, when in actuality, all it does is create cycles of poverty. You know, like, I remember being young enough to be in line with my mom using food stamps and really seeing my dad do it too. And so, you know, it just gives you a completely different perspective. And so that's what I'm really hoping to bring to Washington, D.C., is that life experience that other people read in books, I've lived. And I think it brings a lot more value to that perspective.
No, it's great stuff. And one of the questions I always wonder about, because I actually had, in a certain way, a similar upbringing, just as far as divorce. My dad drank a lot, didn't really see him a whole lot. And I always like, why do you feel like maybe you turned out kind of the way that you did? And what I mean by that is that you hear all of these numbers of, if you grow up in a single parent household, you know, if you don't, you know, do all these certain things, you don't make this much money with your household, like, basically, your chances of being successful in life just keep going down incrementally from each of those. But then I talked to someone like you who went through a lot of these things that maybe would turn someone into that, you know, staying in that same cycle, but you got out of it. Like, why do you think that is for you, that you kind of went this direction when you could have maybe went the other way?
So you're right. Statistically speaking, I remember reading this, like, I should have probably been 16, pregnant, high school dropout, and on drugs. Like, that should have been what I would have ended up as. I think it's a couple things. One, no matter what, I was always raised with some form of faith foundation. So my mom raised me Catholic, and I remember having to go through the first communion process. And then my dad always, when he was sober or when he was around, he would take me to church. And so, I mean, there's so many different factors, but I think that was one where at least I was able to know what right and wrong was. But then also too, I remember at a very early age, I took on a lot of responsibility, because I was essentially parenting my parent with my dad. And then also too, I think with my mom, you know, there's something to be said about when you don't have a father in the household. And I saw that with my mom. I saw it with myself. And really, I mean, you look at the whole dynamic of what a mother's role in the family is and a father's role in the family is. And I think that it's really awful when you see people encouraging divorce and encouraging really the welfare state, because that does remove the father from the household. That does, I mean, even for a child on certain behavioral things, I mean, it changes everything. For me, realizing, I think, just some subtle differences in the fact that, you know, I knew what my dad was doing was wrong, but then I had to take responsibility for him. I think that that's kind of what at least gave me a little bit of guidance. I remember too, though, I mean, I was working from the time I was really 15 to the time, and even to now, I've always had a job. And so I remember, you know, talking to my mom about getting my first job. And then I remember I started working at this cafe in Los Angeles. And there was this guy who was using, and he was using heroin. And I remember he offered it to me. And the reason I said no is because I remember hearing stories about my grandma. And I remember what happened with my own family. So because I saw it, because I knew what happens when people use, that just made me not want to affiliate or even make me curious on the topic. But I do think that a lot of things could have gone differently. Like, I walked into an armed robbery at 9 years old. I could have very easily been shot in the face because I could identify the guy. I was in there with my dad. It was like 10:45 at night at a 7-Eleven in Santa Ana, which at the time in the 90s was really, really bad. Tons of gang activity. There was a shooting at my high school when I was 16 or 17 years old at Venice High School. And I was there when it happened. It happened right out front of my classroom. I could have literally been shot by a stray bullet. And then ultimately, you know, I had a break-in while I was home And the guy thought I was there by myself, and I wasn't. And had it not been for my friend there with me, I probably wouldn't be here today. So I think there's a lot of things that could have happened, and it's by the grace of God that I ended up being okay. But, you know, it's kind of funny because you talk about this and you really bring it to legislative perspective, and you realize that there's a lot of people in office that, one, are completely full of it. They're afraid of even owning their own, you know, stories, because they feel like they have to fit into this box mentality of what it means to run for office. And they forget that it's really about representing the people in your community. And that, I got news for you, but people aren't perfect, and we all have our own stories. And so it's allowed me to connect in a different way.
That's one of the things too, I guess, maybe to jump forward a little bit, because I feel like a lot of good people don't run for office because of what happens to them, just along the lines of what you just said, right? I mean, most normal kind of quote unquote people have got into a little trouble. Maybe they did something that wasn't absolutely perfect. And then to have your family and your life just completely just tarnished, I think there's a lot of good people that are like, why would I want to do that? I mean, whether people like Trump or not, like, obviously I support him. I know that you do. It's like that guy has been absolutely just destroyed in the media for four consecutive years. His family, his youngest son gets destroyed. Like, why would you want to get into that arena and kind of put yourself through that?
I mean, I think I have a different perspective than most, but honestly, like, I don't really give a hoot what people say about me. Actually, it's kind of funny that you bring that up, because I had an experience over the weekend where there was this more, I think, liberal-leaning journalist, and he was trying to poke holes in my entire story growing up. And I was like, look, like, I have zero reason to make any of this up. Like, he was even trying to say that, he's like, I'll have to confirm that you're in the military. Like, bro, don't you think that, you know, my previous job would have confirmed that by now? Like, you can look it up if you do an information request. Like, I don't know what you're trying to prove here. And he ended up calling distant family members, accusing my aunt of being my mom and my uncle of being my older brother. And I'm thinking, bro, you're whack. So I told him, I was like, if you're not going to be respectful, like, I'm obviously not going to talk to you anymore. Like, your access to my campaign is now over. But the thing is like, I also don't care. Like, people are not going to like you because they're just not going to like you. And there's not a dang thing you can do about it. With politics, it's either you have a backbone and you realize that, like, yeah, people are going to argue with you and they might attack you. But, like, I get attacked anyways on a regular basis because I'm standing up for what I believe in. And so for me, it's like, at the end of the day, the truth is always going to come out. And when the truth comes out, it makes those people look bad. And then for the people that do support you, it just gives you more credibility with them. So people can try to attack me, but the way that I look at it is that if we don't stand up for it, then ultimately we're part of the problem. And there should be better people running for office, because I can tell you most people that run for office are not qualified to run for office. It's like one of those things that, you know, the people that want power the most usually aren't fit to hold that power because they're in it for their own reasons. You know, it's not like I really, really, really wanted to do this. I ran and I'm running now because I believe that this is public service and because it has to be done, not because I enjoy getting attacked, you know, and I enjoy these 17-hour days, which is really what it is. So it's a complicated answer, but I'm doing it because it's the right thing. And ultimately, I believe that I have the packaging. I have the same ideologies as most conservatives. I'm just packaged a little bit different, and that helps me fight identity politics, which is really what the progressive left is using on conservatives and the Republican Party.
Well, then why do you think it is that conservatives have had such a hard time connecting with, you know, some of the minority communities, some of the, maybe the inner city? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me, because part of it, I always look at it to where I want to vote for the people who give me, as like the individual, the most amount of power, right?
Yeah.
Like, just leave me alone and let me do stuff. And I feel like sometimes these liberal policies, they enable people to be completely dependent. And then it's like, but after a while, you would think people would be like, okay, what you're doing isn't working. I need to try something else. But it's like, there's cities like Baltimore. It's like 100 years straight of just liberal policy. And it's a crap hole, right? Like, I mean, what is it going to take to reach those people?
The problem is it's largely based in education. A lot of people aren't taught the concept of independent thought. And so, unfortunately, if people see a headline, they believe it's gospel instead of doing their own digging and research. That's the first problem. So I guess society being lazy. And then the second problem is that as a whole, the power control that exists in Washington, D.C. is real. You know, like, if you are a D.C. outsider, it's better for voters, but it's also very, very hard to break into that as an outsider. I mean, my race was a prime, like a prime example of that. I was basically blocked out of DC and I had to raise $1.1 million to be competitive on my own. Now that I've proved that though, and that I'm the pick, obviously, you know, DC and they're working with me. But the point is that if you don't have the drive and you can't hack it and it's a lot of work for a lot of people, I feel like it's insurmountable. And so I kept forward with my plan and I had a feeling that I was going to win. But the point is that the outreach that exists currently, I think because there have been people in office for so long, they don't even realize how my generation, your generation, Gen Z is communicating. You know, like there's nothing actually in place with even social media communications and guidelines for Congress. And you have this aspect of Twitter censorship and big tech censorship. But most people that are in power on both sides don't even really use those platforms to communicate with their voters. So it's a gap. It's like an information, a generational gap. And then also too, there's a huge emphasis on financial control. Like I, had I not had the platform that I do of, you know, basically over 500,000 people, I wouldn't have been able to self-fundraise. Someone like myself could not financially afford to personally bankroll my campaign. Whereas you have other people that can literally drop like 2 million, like it's nothing into their own race. And then that's what they have to really outspend you. And in an instance like myself, like I'm not running in a small district. My district has around 550,000 registered voters, maybe a little bit less. And there's a high voter turnout. So how do you compete with a bombardment of messaging? If you have such a high voter turnout, you have to do that with advertisement. And so that's why congressional campaigns have become so expensive, is because you have media, you have radio, you have targeted digital. So it's this massive machine that's, I think, evolved. And that's not really what the founding fathers anticipated. So if that's not the case for term limits, I don't know what is.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question. So are you in favor of term limits?
Yeah, I've actually signed a term limit pledge. And I also told Andy when I announced, I was like, you know, I gave you 10 years active duty deployments. You give me 10 years in politics and then, you know, I'll put my hat up. And so it's been a year of campaigning. So I have 9 years to go. And I think that if we stay on the trajectory that we're on now, we'll do pretty good. But it's one of those things that it is a joint effort. Like Andy's on the campaign trail with me all the time. I think we're in the process of locking down a joint interview on one of the networks to just talk about who we are as a couple, because people want to know that. They want to feel connected. But also too, I mean, he realizes that you're under scrutiny in the public eye. So we spend a lot of time now in the privacy of our home. And I'm still pretty private about putting him on social media because he's still an active duty military member. But either way, I mean, it's part of the job. So it's almost like an unset expectation.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. So just as far as, so everyone can kind of get an idea, because you hear conservative values or kind of, I mean, maybe the conservative platform. I see one of the things that you post a lot about, it seems like lately, and something that I know is very important to me, being a dad of three daughters, is the child trafficking that's going on. And to me, it's so weird because it seems like if you talk about it, you're some crazy conspiracy theorist, but yet it's kind of something that everybody acknowledges is going on, right? Like I've been a part of Operation Underground Railroad now for several years. The software company I was with was a sponsor for them several years ago. And so they've been somebody I've donated to for a while, but like they're out there doing these missions and they're helping kids, but it's almost like just like, don't talk about it that much. Why do you feel like this doesn't get more traction?
I feel like probably in the last like year and some change, like there's been a little bit more traction on it. Like obviously the White House is doing extensive work. Like I think AG Barr and Ivanka just got $100 million for kind of trafficking.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, which is great. And Tim can tell, I think, talk to you a little bit more about what he does with the White House coalition. But the thing is like, it's not a conspiracy theory. The State Department puts out a report every single year about it. At least here in Florida, Attorney General Ashley Moody's been doing some great work with it. Pam Bondi previously, who was the president's legal defense for the impeachment trial, she did some incredible work with it too. You know, I've had people try to say, oh, like that's a conspiracy theory. No, it's actually not. The State Department has facts. You know, I talked to the local team that exists at the St. Petersburg Police Department, at least like being educated on at least how many cops that they have doing it, which is two, it should be more. But ultimately, I mean, people don't want to talk about it because it's not comfortable. You know, it's not good for ratings. It's depressing. And by the way, if they were to talk about the trafficking that happens at the border, well, guess what? That's a great case for why we need border security. So they're not going to put that out there. So I say that identity politics exists. People just care about power and control. And ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And frankly, talking about trafficking is bad for business. So why would they want to talk about it when it's basically the perfect case for why we need border security? I mean, it just completely punches holes through their argument, especially now that they're so anti-Trump on that entire narrative. What are they going to say? That he's done incredible things for this modern day slavery? They don't want to admit that.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you can't give him credit for anything, right? Do you ever worry about, and I've had conversations with friends of mine, actually, the guy who kind of introduced us, you know, we've had conversations as well about this, but do you worry that, and I don't want to be doom and gloom, but like, do you worry that the divide is so crazy now? And I know that everybody's talking, you know, like in the media talks about the crazy alt-right people, but it's like, those aren't the people I see out there burning down cities. Like, do you feel like there's any way that we can kind of come back together? Like, do you see, I don't know. I try not to be doom and gloom, but it's like,
yeah,
it's crazy right now.
I've gotten to the point where I'm really pretty much for the most part refuse to like reshare those clickbait videos of like rioting and looting because it doesn't help anything, right? But what I realized is that, you know, moving forward, if we do have hope for this country, it's going to be by getting people that are not partisan establishment politicians in office. It's going to be by getting them out. And I think that we really have a good shot at this with a lot of the younger generation. Like, I think Kimberly Clasick might flip Baltimore. You know, Madison Cawthorn, who I met last year at the Statesman Dinner before he was even an announced candidate, he's my friend. He just won in North Carolina. He's not an establishment candidate. You have Burgess Owens, who just won in Utah. You have people around the country that are actually like shattering through what they were supposed to be boxed into. And they're, you know, the people with the right messaging and know how to communicate that messaging. I think that that's really what's needed. I'd say probably not 80% of people don't want the rioting. 80% of people just want to be left the heck alone. And I think that really what this has proved is that the establishment Democrat Party is a problem and that people funding them are a problem. And that really in 2020, it's, you know, do you want to be left alone and have the American dream, or do you want someone that's going to tell you can't eat beef anymore because of the fact that that contributes to CO2 emissions and it's destroying the country while they empower China and send our manufacturing overseas? I mean, that's not what people want. And thank God for the cell phone, because now people can somewhat, if they are, you know, educated enough to do their own research, they can find all the information right here on their phone. So I think that we'll be able to bring it back together, but it'll take President Trump getting into office for 4 more years, cleaning out and really calling out the media. And I think getting people who are not part of the problem in office that can back them up. And then once you have that, I think, massive push, I think you'll be good. But I do think, and just from what I'm doing on, I call it street polls, you know, don't pay attention to the actual polling that you see because it can be so skewed. It's rarely ever straightforward and they take sample sizes and a lot of people don't even want to admit who they're voting for on telephones because it's so uncomfortable right now. But I do think that we'll see a push for Republicans in the House and the Senate and the executive branch, obviously with the president. And then hopefully we'll get a pretty solid conservative into office as SCOTUS.
Well, and the crazy thing to me, because when you talk about, at least in my opinion, and I don't know, maybe I'm just some crazy, you know, country boy in the middle of nowhere, right? But it's like when you talk about conservative principles, it usually comes down to like, we want to leave you alone. But do you feel like that's a message that people, I don't know, like at this point in our country, do people want that? Or do they want the guy who's going to get up there? You know, like I remember listening to Biden in one of his pressers and be like, here's what I'm going to do for you. And it's like, man, I don't want you to do anything for me. I just want you to leave me alone. But is that a winning message now?
It's not the way that it's messages. Usually the winning message is the truth. Like limited government, lower taxes. People always want lower taxes. They want to hold on to their money. But they also don't want chaos. And I think that the message that the Democrats use from a national perspective is really to target those inner city votes that they want to completely push with identity politics. That's why big tech suppresses people like myself, suppresses people like Kimberly Clasick. I mean, you have these people that are not supposed to exist according to what they're saying, and the mainstream media control will, you know, choose to ignore as long as they have to. But the great thing about social media is you really don't need the mainstream media. So that's where the whole argument comes in with big tech censorship and campaign law and campaign finance. So I think moving forward, it's going to be interesting to see, because there's nothing written in legislation yet that defines social media, but I'm sure we're going to see it in the next 10 years. And God willing, I hope that I work on it, because I have a bone to pick with Jack Dorsey at Twitter.
Well, what are you going to do there? Because you know, you do have even some conservatives that are like, hey, it's a private company. They can do what they want. And maybe if you go to the very root of conservative principles, that is a valid argument, right?
The problem with that argument, though, is it might be a problem. Like, it's not an issue with that argument if you're a commentator. It's an issue if you're running for elected office, because then that's election interference. Mm-hmm. And if you can skew the outcome of elections like that, you essentially control the election, which means it's rigged. So that's the argument there. And it hasn't been tested at the Supreme Court level, but I'm sure it will, because I'm sure the founding fathers never anticipated that we'd have cell phones with people just like publicly talking smack to each other on Twitter, and anticipated that that would be something that people would get so upset about that they're censoring you. I mean, you're really, it's stupid. You're so offended that my opinion doesn't matter that you're going to try to suppress it. Like, how JV and, you know, beta testosterone do you have to be for that? You know?
Yes. I got slapped with a partly false on just an opinion that I wrote on Instagram. I mean, it was literally, there was nothing factual. It was just like, you know, talking about Trump being polarizing, and they put like the partly false thing. I'm like, really? This is getting insane. But then,
yeah, and it's going to get worse before the election.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, like even Twitter, and I think some of the social media, people are starting to catch on to, and they're starting to see kind of the hypocrisy. I mean, Biden goes out there and says that 200 million people died from coronavirus the other day, and it's not flagged as false. But, you know, some of the other things are. But I feel like one of the big ones is the search engines, right? Because if you're just legitimately trying to get information on a search engine, you don't expect the results to be skewed. I mean, have you noticed that too?
I mean, that's the problem though. Google really changing algorithms and information. And they've had Google whistleblowers of like people that were Democrats that came out to say, hey, they're trying to fix this and control information, an essential way to control the election. That's going to be something that, again, has to be legislated, but from people that understand it. And that's why it's so important that we get younger people in office, because I hate to say it, but, you know, like, look at what's happening with Joe Biden. He's been in there for 44 years. That's almost like two lifetimes for me, right? In elected office, not doing anything. And, like, you have his team running social media. He doesn't even probably realize the amount of memes that are going around of him that are clipped to show what's happening. And that's going to be really a losing campaign for him because of the amount of stuff that's going viral of him just not even knowing what's happening around him. But that in itself is a way of communicating with the campaign. So it'll be interesting to see, but it is a problem. It's a problem with suppression. It's a problem that Google, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram are all like this together. And so when you have that type of big tech suppression, a perfect example would be Tulsi Gabbard. I absolutely don't agree with her on anything, but she was completely prevented from running fundraising ads, and it's because she didn't agree with the establishment Democrat Party. And they essentially prevented her from becoming president.
Well, then don't you think that that should terrify everybody? I mean, that to me is one of those things to where isn't that kind of like modern day book burning? When you're literally not letting information get out to the public?
Yeah, it is. But people as a whole are not, I think, paying attention as much as they should. So that's why, I mean, my platform is pretty big, and that's why I've been really big on talking about it. There's a lot of people trying to raise awareness on it. But when you have that type of control, it's really hard to do it. So it has to come from the legislative level down.
Yep. So what do you think that maybe for the people out there who are still making their decisions and everything else, like, what do you want? Like, if you were to say maybe your top three kind of your top three list on your agenda that you want when you're elected, this like, hey, this is what the top three things, like, what do you feel like that would be for you?
Veterans issues, ending government corruption, which would include cutting out corporate interest and the lobbying. That's a huge problem. Matt Gaetz will agree with me on that one. That's like a massive issue that we have in DC right now. Obviously including term limits as well. And then also too, I think taking a responsible approach to environmental conservation without raising taxes. The big thing right now is we need to push the new Green Deal is what they're saying, because the world's going to end in 12 years. That's absolutely not true. In fact, conservatives are probably the most environmentally conservative. Obviously you hunt, you're plugged in with what's happening, not, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, DC. So for me, I mean, bringing that change in perspective, I think as a whole could really save the messaging, at least here in my district, but also to bring it to the national perspective and levels of what we should be doing right by our country as we're taking care of our veterans, taking care of, you know, the country environmentally speaking for future generations, and then also to fixing a lot of the problems that currently exist in DC. So I'm really big on my independent grassroots fundraising effort, and frankly, that's why I've been so successful, and I'm not going to stop anytime soon.
Well, that's great. Now, I know the veterans issues are important because obviously with your husband, and I guess maybe for a lot of people that don't understand that, what was that experience like going through witnessing the maybe the care that he got or didn't get, or that situation that brought so much attention?
Yeah, so when he did get shot, obviously, you know, Walter, we did a great job taking care of him. But the problem was, is like after even documenting his injury and then going to the VA to get disability, a rating for it, and to realize that he has the muscle now that's shorter in his left leg, he has two compressed discs, he's been shot, and they gave him a 0% disability rating in hopes that he would just go away. But it's not just him, it's like guys that were exposed to Agent Orange that was known to cause cancer that are still not getting a rating for being exposed and now have cancer and are dying, and those are Vietnam vets. I mean, it shouldn't be like that. The process for the ratings are messed up, and so that's been in part something that I personally experienced, obviously, with him. And you realize that people in DC just don't know the process, so they don't talk about it. And that's, again, like why real life experience is so much more valuable than things that you learn in books, because you haven't gone through it. So how could you legislate on it? But really, I think that, you know, you talk about PTSD, you talk about health privacy and what exists with that, and the fact that, you know, red flag laws pose a risk to veterans that are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Those have been passed. You have them at the national. I mean, there's just so much that I think we need to be worried about as a country, because once you put something into law, it's very hard to take that back. And so the way that these laws are written need to be considered very carefully with the verbiage. And so, you know, going through all of that's really what's kind of given me that perspective.
Sure. Now, kind of moving on, because we don't have a whole lot of time here left, but I know you said like you want to be in the, you know, have term limits, maybe not necessarily looking to be a part of this forever. Like what would be next? Like, let's say you go, you do a bunch of awesome things. Do you want to be president someday? Like where do you see this going after this?
I don't ever want to be president. I think that is the most difficult job on the face of the planet, and so much responsibility. And I just, it is really, I mean, as much respect as I have for it, being president, you see how the guys age every time they leave office. I mean, it's intense. It's a very big stress load, and it is a 24-hour job. Like, I'm already working at a congressional campaign, and it's insane. But, like, having national responsibility plus international relations, I mean, that's insane. Now, I could see myself running as vice president, and that's because you're kind of like the assisting factor and all that, but you're not taking point on it. So I could definitely see myself running as a VP or being someone's pick for vice president. But as far as running for president, I mean, it's possible. Anything's possible. But I would just really prefer vice president.
Do you see yourself kind of staying in the public service arena now and, you know, kind of maybe staying in politics, whether it's Congress, Senate, you know, maybe VP or president someday, or like, yeah, do you look at this as just being a short time thing for you?
I mean, I'm for term limits. Obviously I would not stay in Congress forever. I'm at most thinking probably 3 terms, but if I did the math correctly, I'd be eligible to be a VP nominee in 2024. Okay. And so for me, it would basically be the perfect segue out. And then if I don't win it, I don't win it, but at least, you know, I gave it a shot.
Yep. So, I mean, God forbid you don't win, and I think you're going to, but God forbid if you don't, where do you see, I mean, do you see this being something you want to come back and try next time, or?
I think no matter what, there's a win-win-win, right? Like, I'm in one of, to put it in perspective, Florida off the I-4 corridor is considered the path to the White House, and Tampa Bay is off the I-4 corridor, meaning the president needs to secure this seat to secure Florida, to secure the electoral votes for the White House. So as long as, like, I help him win this area and get into office, I know I did my job, because I do believe that he's doing incredible things for this country. But as far as running for Congress, at least again, I don't think so. Just because I've spent a year already of my life campaigning, and it is not easy. It is a full-time job. You are invested 16 hours a day. I mean, it is a really big, really big responsibility. But it doesn't necessarily mean I'll leave the political sector. I think that I have a massive platform that I'll continue to educate and promote and reach out to people in regards to pushing the conservative message. But I just don't know that it would be in this exact arena. I remember I did get into a med program. And so for me, you know, I could always go back to medicine and do this for fun on the side.
Yeah. Yeah. Either way you can help people, right?
Yeah. Either way I'd help people. And I think that that's really what it's all about. So
awesome. So I want to kind of start wrapping it up here. And again, I really appreciate you coming on. So really on the podcast, we like to talk about liberation as far as just mindset, helping people maybe get out of a funk that they're in, or maybe a certain path of kind of the mindset that they're in. If you could look back over your life and maybe you could give everybody one lesson or one tip on how, I mean, again, how do you go from kind of your upbringing into where you are now, and you've got hundreds of thousands of followers and you've got all this influence. And again, whether you win or lose, like you've built, you know, an awesome kind of backing and people are supporting you. And again, like you have real influence. Like, what do you feel like if you could give somebody one tip to kind of help go from where they are to where they want to be? What do you think it's been for you?
I think I remember I saw a quote, and I'm not going to quote it exactly, but it said, don't listen to the people that say you can't do something. If you listen to the voice that says that you can, it's people like us that end up changing the world. And I really believe that. If I could tell you the amount of people that told me I couldn't do this, that I was going to lose my race, that I had no chance, that I shouldn't even try, I mean, I would be nowhere. So I've never ever listen to those people. I've gone with my gut. So always listen to your gut, always believe that you can and you will accomplish. But that also too, I mean, what's the point in being afraid to do something? You're going to die anyways. So you may as well have made impact so that when you die, you know that at least you left the world a better place. And that's what I firmly believe in. So I'm not afraid of anything. I mean, people told me they're like, they're going to smear your family. They're going to do all this. I'm like, okay. And I know the truth. So am I really going to not do the right thing because I'm afraid of what people may do or may not do? For every person that's going to open their mouth and say something negative about you, there's going to be 10 people that will secretly say positive or believe in you. So I do it for those 10, not that one.
Where'd you get that attitude from though? Like, have you always had it, or is it something you've developed?
I think I always kind of just did my own thing. You can actually like hear stories about my mom when I was younger. I was just a very sassy child. I remember she would tell me that like people would come up and try to talk to her because my parents were never together, but my parents were basically divorced, but my parents were never married. And I think she would say that like when I was little, there'd be like grown men trying to come up and talk to her. I'd tell them, go away, I don't like you. And my mom always says that it's because she never suppressed my voice that I am who I am today. But I really just believe that I think that I'm just kind of a no BS kind of person. And I used to kind of be a little bit more quiet and timid. But I think what it came down to is I eventually just went through so much stuff that I was like, screw this. If I don't, you know, help myself, no one's going to help me. So I just kind of picked myself up by my bootstraps, as they say, and it's worked out very good.
Oh, I love it. The second thing that we talk a lot about is just the lifestyle. Obviously I know that you've been able to create this lifestyle, even though it's crazy and it's hectic, but you've been able to impact so many people because of it. Do you look back and I guess maybe have any regrets about dedicating so much time when maybe you could have gone a different way? I mean, is there any like trepidation or any hesitancy to stay with this?
I just wish when I was younger, like I meet kids now, I have 16-year-old volunteers, I have 18-year-old interns. Like I have so many young kids that got into it early. Kudos to their parents. Some of them have done it on their own because of social media and they came across profiles that they just felt the need to do it. But I just wish earlier on I would have, I think, been more invested or like been more educated on this. Now, my defense, no one in my family is political and I wasn't exposed to this in the way that I didn't have structure. So, you know, I am who I am because of my upbringing, because of my story. And I think that that's why I'm in the place that I am now, because I experienced all those things. But I just wish that if I was younger, I mean, who knows where I'd be at now. But I will say when I made the decision not to go to medical school, I knew for a fact I would be running for Congress. And I knew for a fact, I had a feeling that I would, but I also knew for a fact that I was probably closing that chapter in my life and I was going to go a different route, but that it was going to be pretty epic no matter what I decided to do. And it has been. I mean, I literally went from, and I think when you're on the right path, you go from here to here very quickly. And that's basically what happened is I closed the door on medical school and all of a sudden I was on network television and I was commentating and then I was in the White House 2.5 months later. And then it was just the sky's the limit at that point. So,
wow.
And you know, moving forward, I mean, I've spoken to the president is a very good person. very dedicated person, will do some great things for this country in a second term. And I do think he'll secure it. And you know what? God forbid I don't lose. I definitely can tell you I'm putting in my application right at the White House.
Nice. Well, I'm sure you'd have a spot there. And then the last thing, before I ask you the last question and we get you out of here, where can people find you if they want to contribute to the campaign, if they want to help out in any way, or maybe they just want to follow along? Where's the best places to find you?
You can head over to voteonapaulina.com. That's my campaign website, or any one of my social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Parler, at Real Ana Paulina. I'm verified on every other platform except for Twitter, and that's because I have an ongoing Twitter war. So,
Jack Dorsey better watch out. He's got a lot of people mad. Better.
I was joking today, but I was like, you know, God willing, I make it in. My first tweet after I get elected is going to be, "See your ass in Congress, Jack."
I love it. All right, so again, guys, go out there and support her in any way you can. Follow along. Make sure because she's awesome. If you obviously have been following the podcast, I assume we probably have somewhat similar values in a lot of these ways, and obviously Ana represents those. So check her out and help her out any way possible. All right. So the very last question, we talk a lot about liberation, lifestyle, and the last one is legacy. So, you know, many, many years from now, I know you're still very young. When you maybe get to the end of your life and you look back and it is time to leave the world here, what do you want the legacy of you to be?
That I took care of veterans. I want to be known as a human rights advocate and hopefully the first female vice president of the United States.
You say the first female president?
Vice president.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, you know, I see what you did there.
All right. Awesome. Well, again, everybody go out there. Make sure you check out her website, follow her on social media, give her some support, and let's help Ana get a win on November 3rd. Thanks again, Ana, for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of the Primal King Podcast. There is one thing that I will ask you to do. Please make sure that you are subscribed to the show so you get all of the new episodes coming out. Also, please make sure that you rate and review the show so that way other people can have access to this podcast, to this content, and this community. Again, thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time.